Morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining me for today's episode of SMIE Consulting's Midweek Roundup. I'm your host, Marty Bennett, and for the next half hour or so, we'll be talking our way through three topics in international education news that have come across our feeds in the last few days. And we'll invite you to participate in the discussion today and to share your thoughts on what may be the most important pieces related to what you do in international education. So as we start out each week at SMIE Consulting on the Roundup, we take a moment to remind you of some of the services with which you can become more acquainted that SMIE Consulting provides, and a great summary of those are available on our smieconsulting.org website, putting the links to all of these in the comments section on the Facebook page, so really encourage you to check that out and bookmark that if you haven't already. Matt Lama, how good to see you. How are things there in Virginia? It's been a while. Hope you're well. We're looking forward this week to talking our way through three issues related to international students and their study in the United States. And as we do each week, the three stories we cover, we feature in our SMIE Consulting e-newsletter that comes out on Monday mornings. That newsletter, all the SMIE news fit to share, comes out at 9 a.m. on Monday, and we pick three of those articles to feature here on the Midweek Roundup on Wednesdays. So those three stories this week are international students and their views on the value of their degrees in the United States. And then in looking at a recent spate of Iranian students who were denied visas or denied entry into the United States, by having their visas canceled before they even entered the United States, getting to their connecting flights, and we'll take a look at our call for reason related to visa cancellations, and then we'll also look at what the test optional movement is, a new direction, moving in graduate programs, becoming test optional and eliminating the GRE. We'll take a look at what that might mean for international admissions programs around the country. But as I want to do each week is make a particular plug for the newsletter. If you subscribe to that, you'll get that in your inbox. I put the link to the latest edition of the newsletter that came out on Monday. Please go to the subscribe button on that link, from that link, and you'll be able to we'll add you to the newsletter for the upcoming editions coming out every Monday at 9 a.m. Eastern. So let's get into the first topic of the day. WES is an organization that's been around for several years and is primarily known as a credential evaluator, one of the major credential evaluators in the country. But they also have a very extensive research arm, and that does surveys and analysis of different markets around the world and how that impacts U.S. education and that type of thing. So they've come up with their latest report out of World Education News and Reviews. They're kind of the research arm of what they do. And it's a study that looked at alumni of international alumni of U.S. institutions and how what their opinions were of the value of their degree, their salary, their experience in the United States, and so on. So it surveyed approximately 1,655 graduates of U.S. educational institutions who graduated between 2012 and 2019, and that was conducted in February and March earlier this year. So according to the results, which were largely positive for U.S. institutions, for those graduates between 2012 and 2019, 91% said that they agreed that the U.S., their study abroad experience developed their ability to get along with people different from myself. 90% increased their general knowledge and gave them a well-rounded education. 90% said they helped give me a global perspective. 89% said it was a good investment for my future. 88% developed my problem-solving skills. So they're largely positive in terms of the impact of their U.S. education experience. Now, where international graduates currently reside, the WES survey had five major concentrations of students that responded to this, or graduates that responded to the survey, from Nigeria, Philippines, India, China, and Saudi Arabia. Interestingly, when asked where international graduates currently reside, For Nigeria and the Philippines, 85% or above said they're living in the United States. India was at 83%. China, 57% living in the United States. And Saudi Arabia, only 8% were in the United States. And 84% said they were back home in Saudi. And the reason for that is, as you can guess, for anyone who's been in international ed for more than a minute, realizes that they had scholarships from the kingdom that were tied to jobs back in their home country, and that's a reason for why the lion's share are back there. When asked about the value of their U.S. degree, agreeing with the concept that the U.S. degree is valuable in the country that I'm living in. Nigeria, Philippines, China, all 91% or above in terms of their recognition, yes, their U.S. degree is valuable. 85% for Saudi Arabia and India. So clearly, greater majority of students, international students that graduate with U.S. degrees, consider that their having a U.S. degree is of a great value to them. When asked whether the agreement that studying and earning a degree in the U.S. was worth the cost, tuition plus living expenses, 89% of Philippine students said yes. Nigeria, only 81%. Saudi Arabia, 78%. India, 76%, 75%, and China. So all three quarters or above saying yes, it's worth the cost in terms of that. So that might be certainly an area U.S. knows it's one of the most expensive, if not the most expensive destination market for students. So is it worth that cost? On the lion's share of students, yes, it is, three quarters or above. But that's still an area of concern, why that's not more. Now, career outcomes for international alumni, that certainly lion's share again, 89% studying in the U.S. increased my specific expertise and knowledge in the career I've chosen. 86% feel positive about career prospects and employability. 85% saying studying in the U.S. helped me form a global network. 75% saying they have more job opportunities because of their degree. So that's encouraging there, certainly. Those numbers are relatively positive. Where we see for students that are living back home, the lion's share, again, are employed full-time. 83% Filipino students are employed full-time. 76% of Indians, 69% of Chinese, 67% of Nigerians, 66% of Saudis. Saudis had the largest unemployment rate, and this is reflective of, I think, a larger trend and issue in Saudi Arabia, that the jobs just aren't there for them, for these returning graduates with these university degrees from the States. Now, there are a lot of things in here that made the questions that I certainly caught my eye and some other observers that about their experiences. If they could do it all over again, these students were asked, alumni were asked, would they go to the same institution or would they go to a different institution? Philippine students seem to be the most loyal to their alma mater. 60% said that they would go to the same school, whereas only 26% said they'd go somewhere else. The numbers really are quite interesting for Saudi Arabian students. 46% said they'd go somewhere else. 41% of Indian students would go somewhere else. 43% of Chinese and 39% of Nigerian students. So interesting to see the larger percentages there, though not majorities, certainly greater minorities of pluralities of students from these countries say that they might go to a different institution if they had a choice. So that's interesting. Wes comes up with three recommendations for institutions moving forward. I think all three are very valid and worth knowing. First, expanding networking opportunities, the opportunities for international students to network with themselves as well as with other international alums from those institutions. There is an enhanced recommendation for enhanced visa advising. And we're not talking about incoming students, we're talking about students before they move on from the university to career opportunities for post-study work through OPT and eventually H-1B or L-2 or L-1 or other types of visas that they might be eligible for. So having that baked in at the end of their studies, not just coming before they get to your campus. And a third, and probably an area that is more lacking at most institutions than anything else related to international students services, is expanded career service support. Because oftentimes the Career Services Center handles that, and international office isn't really involved. Those campuses that are actively involved are certainly bridging this gap better, and certainly helping to prepare, work with our Career Services Centers to make the experience for international students that is tailored to them, not just the general information, and half of which doesn't apply when it comes to employment opportunities, and companies that are willing to work with international students that come to campus to do interviews that oftentimes will not include international students. So there's a lot of issues there, and I think that Wes' recommendation is a very valid one. So good report from Wes, and certainly encouraged to see that coming out, and there are certainly going to be more opportunities for those topics that Wes addressed to be discussed in further detail on your campuses, and how well you're doing as it stands relation to those three issues. So, next topic of the day. We've all heard the stories of visa cancellations, students that landed in the U.S., were detained, went to secondary screening, and then were sent back home. A group of returning Chinese students going to Arizona State were sent back after they came in Los Angeles. We heard about the Palestinian student, Palestinian refugee who was coming from Lebanon on a full scholarship came to the United States, detained, and turned around and sent back because supposedly for social media posts that his friend had made that were anti-American. And then the good news on that side, that student eventually was able to enroll and attend Harvard in time for classes that started this fall. And you also have heard about the group, we've talked about it here on the Roundup last week or two, about this group of Iranian students going to various UC schools and others around the country that were not even allowed to come to a U.S. airport. They were turned back at that connection point overseas before coming to the United States. They were they had their visas canceled on the spot. This is what I want to talk about today. This main issue here I see as probably one of the greatest failings of U.S. legal system, this current administration, related to international students. We know that when the travel bans were announced shortly after President Trump was inaugurated, there were, in the three versions, there were, and the final one that was approved, there were exemptions to those travel bans built in for student visa holders, or that would allow students to get to apply and receive visas and be admitted. That process, even though the travel bans were upheld by the Supreme Court in modified versions, it still left open the possibility that international students from Iran, from Libya, from the other countries that were affected by these travel bans could still enter the United States for study legally if they were given a visa. With Iran, this is a situation where those in international student recruitment know that, well, since the U.S. hasn't had an embassy in Tehran since the late 70s, since 79, 80, that Iranian students that were looking to come to the United States for study had to apply for visas outside of Tehran, in Armenia, in Dubai, in Turkey. So those were some of the common places where they went to get their visas. What had happened, that even though the travel bans included exemptions that allowed Iranian students to apply and receive visas, what has happened, the reality on the ground has been, these students have received the extensive secondary screening and administrative security processing, administrative processing that we haven't seen since the immediate days post 9/11. There were Iranian students that it would take 6 to 12 months for their visa applications to be reviewed and or hopefully eventually approved. Those delays ended up causing many Iranian students that had been offered places with scholarships that were forced to wait too long that it became just unfeasible for them to eventually enroll at their intended U.S. institution because their visas just getting delayed and they pushed them an additional semester or two beyond when they were initially wanted to come in. And my call for reason is this. These Iranian students, and there were at least a dozen that were turned away when they had their visas approved after this long 6 to 12 month process of applying for the visas, going through the administrative processing path by the U.S. Department of State. These embassies and consulates, and the process has not really changed that much other than other agencies getting involved, but there were name checks that would go through these series of agencies that provide this kind of service for known terrorists and other criminal databases around the world, Interpol and others, that names would go through these agencies and be checked over a series of months to verify whether or not the student was legitimate and their intentions were positive and are appropriate for what they were intending to come to the United States for. So that happened. In order for them to have gotten their visas, they would have, these Iranian students have gone through that entire process. Then they get their visas. The student that's profiled in the article that I've just shared in the Chronicle is an Iranian student that was going to UC Irvine, I think it might be. UC San Diego, excuse me. Yeah, he had gotten his visa literally 2 weeks before he was about to leave for California for his for studies. This student had already waited months in that 6 to 12 month range we were talking about earlier to get his initial visa from the State Department. I think he had gone to Dubai or Qatar for his visa appointment, and then he was getting his connecting flight from Iran to Qatar, connecting in Doha for his flight to the United States. And he was met, before he was able to board that flight to the United States in Qatar, he was met by a U.S. Customs official, probably a CBP representative. And those who travel through Europe and the Middle East that have direct flights to the United States know that there's oftentimes, I know I've gone through it several times in Amsterdam, and you would go through these reviews where you'd have a CBP officer actually check your documents before you're allowed to board the plane. In this case, this Iranian student in Qatar, as well as the many others, the at least 12 others that were also denied entry to even come into the U.S. And land at an airport, who had valid visas, this student had his visa canceled on the spot. This Border Patrol officer met him in Qatar before he was able to board the plane, wrote canceled on his visa, and he was forced to buy a return ticket to Tehran. When he was told that you can contact the embassy where you got your visa initially, he did that, and they were, at the embassy in Qatar, they were sympathetic, understandably so, to the student's cause. Yet there was never a reason given by the CBP officer. He just said, you're not getting on this plane. Why would this happen? The DHS has access to the same databases and criminal agencies, criminal background check agencies, Interpol, all of these other U.S. agencies that exist that do these background checks. Why would they make a decision to deny entry to that student, or even the ability to get on a plane to come to the United States and then maybe be denied when he got there? Why would they do that to that student after having access to all that same information that the State Department folks had when they evaluated that student to eventually award him a visa after 6 to 12 months of processing? How is that even logically explainable, that they could make a decision for a group of students like this? Yes, they're in STEM fields. No, they're not nuclear engineers or anything like that. These this one student that was denied, the Chronicle article discusses, it was he was studying artificial intelligence. Are their subject areas so directly tied to national security that was not something that would be even allowed into the United States? And that's just something that's just shocking to me. When State Department, if they ever had any doubts about that student's intentions, or if that student's goals were anything that were not in line with national security policy, which gets our interests, which gets thrown around probably too loosely in many people's eyes, I think, in international education to justify denying the student a visa. If they were able to award a visa to him, what happened in 2 weeks for this whole group of students, same group of students, that all of them are all of a sudden unable to be admitted to the United States, and Customs Border Patrol officers invalidating their visas before they could even get on a connecting flight to the United States? Doesn't make any sense. So it's really a plea for reason, and certainly those of you who are involved in advocacy to your elected officials, hopefully you can add this to your long list of concerns. I know you already have when it comes to government policy on these things, because it is putting up a very poor image for the United States, where we are making it increasingly harder for international students that have gone through so many hoops to get visas to come to the United States to be pulled down at the last hurdle so unfairly. It's just beyond me. So hopefully this is a call for reason for amongst our elected officials to put pressure on Homeland Security and state to be more accommodating of international students and less restricting of international students, because they are our way to help diffuse a lot of the tensions that exist in the world by having people who come to this country who come from countries whose governments don't like us, and then experience the positivity of the American people, of the culture, of our institutions. That is what makes our world a more peaceful place, is when those students go home and they share. It's not like we think it is, like our government elected officials tell us it is, or our dictators tell us it is. So it's really something that we, I think, have a responsibility for, and I wish more of our international education family would take up that advocacy role with their elected officials and how you can do that. NAFSA does a great job of giving tools to help you do that. So take advantage of those. Now, when we talk about hurdles that prevent students from coming to the United States, we've talked a long time about test scores. And at the undergraduate level, we've shared a number of stories over the last year and a bit about how institutions are becoming test optional. There's been a growing trend in this. University of Chicago was the big news story last year, but now there are well over 1,000 institutions in the U.S. that are test optional, SAT or ACT optional, for undergraduate applicants, freshman applicants. But the caveat on that is that the greater majority of those are still requiring SAT, ACT for, even of those test optional schools, are requiring SAT, ACT for international students. So you've heard me talk about that before. I won't go into more detail on that, because I think that's a case that makes itself when it comes to barriers that we put up as institutions to international students to study in the United States. So for me, on the graduate side, we look at how the admissions process is for graduate applications to the United States. There are typically, if you're looking at a doctoral program, there are very, very few schools that have on-campus seated programs that take anything other than a fall intake for their PhD programs. And the various reasons for that, funding-wise and other teaching capacity, whatever it might be. So a lot of challenges at the doctoral level. At the master's level, it's a little bit more flexible with entries usually in the fall, spring, and maybe in some summer programs. But what has often held back graduate programs in the United States are the additional testing requirements. If you look at the UK, you look at Australia, you look at Canada, they don't require, with very few exceptions, they don't require any standardized tests other than English proficiency. They use the English proficiency and their students' academic performance from their bachelor's and or master's degree programs to determine eligibility for entrance. Because they've been doing it long enough, they understand systems well enough that they know what it looks like an admissible candidate for a master's or a doctoral program. In the U.S., we've had this system in place where SAT, ACT for undergraduates, GRE, GMAT for graduates have been in place for so long that it's almost considered, well, we've got to have those standardized tests that really are standardized tests for Americans who learned American English in American high schools. So international students don't fit into those boxes, if they were educated in the U.S., they might be in that situation where that might be a potentially comparable test or important test or relevant test for them to take. But for students that are coming from outside the United States into a graduate program in the U.S., why are they taking a GRE or GMAT? Well, it's a standard we apply for U.S. students. Why shouldn't we apply it for international students? And international students have had to jump through that hoop for decades. The problem is that we're the only country in the world that does that to a large extent for our graduate programs. You can get into a UK program in the summer as an international student in the summer before you want to start. You can apply and get in through a process they call clearing in the UK, where you can apply in July and start your studies in the fall. As a doctoral student, you can't do that in the US. There is no way on God's green earth that would ever happen. So what's surprising, and there's now a move at some of the more prestigious institutions in the country, we've seen it at Brown and Princeton, where there have been, at Brown we've seen 24 of their graduate departments have opted out of the GRE. Princeton had done that earlier, where 14 of its departments have dropped the GRE as a requirement. There are other institutions that have dropped that, and surprisingly, all in Ivy League schools. Yale's history department, go history, drops the GRE. Cornell's English department, and Harvard's English department, and philosophy department at Penn have all dropped that. And the institution, these Ivy League institutions have dropped it because in a goal to diversify their incoming classes. Much of the reason, the stated justification why that's being done for undergraduate institutions. It's interesting to see, it's kind of the opposite in terms of how these happen first at the graduate level. It's the Ivies that are leading the way on going test optional for GRE. But at the undergrad, they've been kind of bucking the trend, the higher, more selective schools. So interested to see where that goes. And certainly for graduate education, we've seen, certainly over the last 5-6 years, we've seen a significant drop in graduate interest in the United States. The Council of Graduate Schools report from last fall, or from 2018, just released in the last couple of weeks, related there was a 1.8% drop in enrolled internationals in 2018, probably something similar to that, if not more, this fall. We've seen stories, we'll have one next week, about elite MBA programs seeing dramatic drop-offs in international applicants. So there has been a significant drop-off in graduate-level interest in the United States. And I think that's what you're going to see is driving the majority of the drops you'll see in November for Open Doors will be on the graduate side, from India, from China, and Saudi Arabia. But what we'll see here, I think, with this is a recognition on the part of these Ivy League schools that our current way of doing things makes it too complex and too difficult for international students to get in. When you look at it in comparison to our competition, and this is something I've been preaching for the last year and a half here on the Roundup, is how important it is to view our processes through the lens of our global competition. And this is where U.S. institutions really need to get to grips with what's going on in the world, because other countries make it so simple to apply and be admitted to their graduate programs, to their undergraduate programs too. But even at the graduate level, it makes it such a more streamlined process to go through and have multiple points of entry, to not have these other standardized tests beyond English proficiency tests. So it makes it a different process entirely. And then when you factor in how hard it is admission-wise to get in, how difficult it's becoming to get a visa, what the costs are for U.S. higher education, particularly at the graduate level if you don't have a scholarship, those are barriers that make us, and we haven't even gotten to visa processing and jobs after graduation. Those are things that drive students abroad to study outside their home country. They're looking for better opportunities. And if we have opportunities that may be good on paper, but we put up all these roadblocks to entry into the United States to be able to sustain them while they're here, to give them a useful pathway for post-study work, these are things that will hold us back when we're looking at our competitors in Australia, the UK, Canada. Their policies are much more welcoming, frankly, to international students beyond their time on our campuses. So there's really a lot more we can do on that. And related to it, we look at how easy it is in Australia. They have, I'll switch gears and I'll just throw this out there, for it's not one of the three main stories we're covering today, but I don't know if you caught it, but there is a university in Australia called University of Adelaide that now is using a chatbot, to do some automation of the admissions process for prospective students to connect with this chatbot, and students would input their scores and their academic averages, the countries they're from, pay an application fee. When they do that, they can find out if they're eligible to apply and if they're admissible based on these academic averages and maybe their English test scores as well. That's happening now in Adelaide, and they've seen their applications double the number of international students to their campus. So it's really seeing, they're looking to double their in size in the next 3 to 5 years, but they're seeing just huge growth in their applicant pool from international students because of this chatbot. And it's interesting to see where that goes, and we'll certainly be keeping tabs on any other institutions that might do that. But they're able to do that in Australia because their admissions process is a much more streamlined one. They're able to have a kind of a more black and white process, which we clearly do not have, particularly at graduate level in the United States. So interesting to see where that goes, and we'll be keeping our ears and eyes open on those kinds of stories. But for now, invite you to, again, subscribe to the newsletter. Check out the archive of the roundups on our YouTube channel or here on the Facebook page. And for those that like podcasting, our midweek roundup is podcasted on all the major platforms: iTunes, Google Play, Podbean, Stitcher, Spotify. So please check us out on your favorite platforms, and we look forward to seeing you next week. Hopefully not next week. Next week I'll be at a funeral, unfortunately, but we'll reconnect on October 30th, pre-Halloween edition. So hope to see you in a couple of weeks. Take care.